All right. Okay.
Okay. Wait for Danielle.
All right, well, let's continue. Our next topic, we're going to be talking about the scope of the proposal, and I'll ask Lisa again to tee that up.
Thank you. Okay, this time we're going to go to page 6, and we're going to look at questions 9 through 11. This is going to cover your definition of a lease and separating lease components. Just to refresh your memory, the definition of a lease based on the CD is a contract that conveys the right to use an asset, the underlying asset, for a period of time in exchange for consideration. That's dependent upon having an identified asset and the lessee having control over that asset. As far as separating lease and non-lease components, they should be separated if the lessee is able to obtain a standalone observable price. So with that, again, we'll ask whether you agree, disagree, any suggested solutions, etc.
Okay, we'd like to start off our discussion on the scope of the proposal.
You guys are killing me here. Somebody come say on. Something.
I was going to say, but Danielle's two topics, no problem at all. Lisa's.
I'm one for four.
Come on, the scope of the proposal.
You know,
hey, John, thank you.
We do
thank
accept you. Perfect as a good response.
Well, this is really kind of a technical question, but our committee wondered why there's an A. In this, whether fulfillment of the contract depends upon the use of an identified asset. Why does the use have to be there? Why couldn't you just have B as the criteria? As if you have the contract to control the asset, the use of the asset, you've tied it up, and you're, so why is the use included?
I think it's more on the focus is on the identified asset. The asset has to be identified in A.
Right, but it's also in B, isn't it? Identified asset. We just didn't understand why there was an A, and we thought there might, that somebody wrote A, and maybe we just missed it.
Sorry, so you're thinking if you still have a lease and you're not using that asset during the term, you would still have to make the payments, or?
Right, or if you don't use it immediately, you tie it up for a period of time and you haven't used it yet, but isn't it still a lease? Don't you still account for it the same? We just didn't understand why there was an A.
Is the reason B actually requires a specifically identified asset, and A says you could have a contract where by nature you could only be using one asset to fulfill it, so it might not?
It says identified asset too in both.
Sounds okay, like a point for us to consider.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll point taken.
Okay. Go ahead, Brad.
When it comes to the scope, you know, I think if all leases do come on balance sheet, it is important to separate the lease components from the non-lease components. The one area where this adds a little bit of complexity from our customer's perspective, which would be our dealer, is that it's going to lead to the potential unbundling of certain transactions. And if I use a copier transaction as an example, you know, there's going to be a lot of instances where the lessee doesn't want to have to worry about service, supplies. They don't want to have to worry about the insurance, the property taxes under their lease. And so a lot of our dealers come to market with a bundled transaction or a bundled solution. The fact that we also have minimums in there, you know, you could suggest that that's the lease payment, but that minimum lease payment includes both a component of a lease component for the financing of the asset, as well as the non-lease components that would go to the dealer. And so the one thing that we think that this will do is it'll add complexity to our lessee, because under today's model, I said earlier we originate all direct finance leases, but from our lessee's perspective, the fact that there's an operating lease option out there, they're able to make the decision that, you know, this includes a service component, so I'm going to call this an operating lease, and I'm just going to disclose this in my financial statements. Under the new rules, I think there's going to be more scrutiny on unbundling that transaction in order for them to do the proper accounting, which again is going to add complexity for them to put some portion of that transaction on their balance sheet.
Is that problematic for you as the lessor, and why?
It's not problematic from our perspective. It's more from our customer's perspective and the way that they go to market, that it'll, I guess, disrupt a little bit of what their model is. And I think from the lessee's perspective as well, by it adding complexity to them, all that they're worried about under their copy release is they want the ability to make copies.
Sorry, and also to follow up on that, would it be helpful if there was some, I guess, maybe allowance to not separate? Would that help? Or then, I mean, you would have a larger liability, essentially.
I think that's going to be the challenge, is that they would then have a larger liability. And my expectation would be that people are going to want to try to minimize the impacts to their balance sheet of this just because of the potential financial covenant implications that it could have.
Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
On some of the equipment that we participate in, I hear what Brett's saying. However, what is the reality of it? They need that service component in order to operate that equipment for whatever that time frame is. So if you're going back to what the little transaction is occurring, I understand it would be a larger liability from a lessee standpoint. Maybe that is the correct, not that I like the answer, but maybe that is the correct way, at least in our world. Maybe from a copier standpoint, anybody can service it. And some of the things we deal with, you want the manufacturer servicing that and no one else.
Okay. Anything else with regard to the scope of the proposal? Matt Brewer?
Yes, I just reiterate that for Nakubo's purposes, or from Nakubo's perspective, with respect to leases of property that's held as investment and carried at fair value, it'd be scoped out from this proposed standard. And I think it's on page 4, the penultimate paragraph calls for something similar to IAS 40 instead, where the income stream is recognized as earned, but there's no asset for that income stream.
Okay. Again, this is when it's in endowments or other investment portfolios.
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
There are a couple comments and comment letters on the short-term lease
definition.
The
short-term lease definition, any issues?
Well, I think just we talked about earlier talked about this that limiting that to just 1 year may not be entirely functional or accurate in terms of what goes on in the industry. So perhaps defining that differently as opposed to just 12 months.
Go ahead, John.
And my earlier comment that having the option, we don't believe should kick out the fact that it's a short-term lease. If there's no economic incentive to exercise the option, what's the harm in having the option? Doesn't seem to make sense.
Okay. Anything else in this area? Tom? No? Okay.
The struggle was an anti-abuse provision.
Right.
So that, but we've got a greater challenge about small ticket items anyhow.
Okay. Terrific. Okay. So why don't we move on to the next topic, which I'll tee up, and that's on other aspects of the proposals. A couple specific other aspects, and then we'll talk about some non-public entity considerations. So two of the the exposure draft contains various other proposals, and two that are noteworthy, two areas of proposals, regard transition and disclosure. In the transition area, the proposal lays out a modified retrospective application approach, which includes certain simplifications and cost reliefs, as well as the option to use, in lieu of that, a full retrospective transition approach. In the area of disclosures, there are qualitative, quantitative, and some general risk type disclosures that are proposed for both lessees and for lessors. In addition to those two areas, the FASB exposure draft also proposes specified reliefs for non-public entities, that is, private companies and not-for-profit organizations, in a couple of areas. And those areas have to do with the discount rate to be used to discount the asset and the liability. And what we had heard from a number of private company stakeholders, and I think even some not-for-profit stakeholders as well, especially on the smaller end, is that they may not be engaged in significant borrowings. They may have some difficulty in determining what an incremental borrowing rate for them is. So we, the FASB, proposed an alternative to instead use a risk-free discount rate of comparable duration to measure the lease liability and, of course, the lease asset as well. Again, some disclosure around that. In addition to that, we exempted non-public entities or proposed to exempt non-public entities from one of the disclosure requirements, and that is the roll-forward disclosure of the leased liability. And then finally, I think as we briefly mentioned earlier, we also proposed a change to the current U.S. GAAP guidance regarding related party leases, which are, again, very prevalent, at least in the private company sector. And that is to move away from the trying to look through the form of the lease, the legally enforceable form of the lease, to try to determine what the underlying substance is. That's what current U.S. GAAP would have you do. We've instead proposed to account for the legally enforceable form of the lease with some re-emphasis on the related party disclosures. So with that, do you have any specific concerns about any of these areas? Especially, again, the non-public entity areas, because this is the roundtable. We're really trying to probe that a little bit. And if you do have concerns, is there anything that the board can do in its continued redeliberations to help address those concerns? So who wants to start? Come on, don't make me like Lisa. Or you're not, okay, go ahead, John.
All right. First, the idea of this reconciliation, we thought that that should be exempted for quarterly financials.
For quarterly.
Reconciliation of the opening and closing balances, that we suggested that that not be done, be done only annually.
You're talking about for all entities?
For all entities.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's, and the idea, unless there was some significant change, sale of assets or something like, or discontinuation of leases or something like that. The thing that our committee didn't like at all was the retroactive change. That was long debated and strong preference for prospective change. The idea being especially leases that had terminated before the current year, having to go back and figure out what they were, this just seemed like a lot of trouble to our committee members for not much benefit.
Again, there's a difference here between modified retroactive and that retrospective, and that would be an example of that.
They didn't like modified either, just prospective.
Just pure prospective, which is Larry had laid that out as a, I think, a possibility at the last, our proposal at the last roundtable.
And in your discussions with your committee, were they were willing to trade off comparability for potentially long periods going forward for that?
Yes. It just the idea of trying to go back and get that information and deal with it was seemed overwhelming to the group.
Did the committee talk about 30 years of two different models?
Only 25. I think, you know, we had a spirited discussion about this, and there were many people who thought this was just going to create a lot of trouble for the clients and for, and they just didn't like it at all.
Are there users on your accounting committee, and or have? Were any of the members speaking on their knowledge of how users might react?
No, these are the discussion here was dominated by the folks who are smaller practitioners, regional practitioners, and their non-public clients, and how much trouble it would be to try and scare up this information. And practitioners believed that the bankers who were using this information wouldn't care about it.
Okay. I have Matt, then Mark, then Annette. Okay, Matt.
Nakubo suggests for the transition that we an offer of a cumulative effect adjustment taken in the year of adoption be made. Therefore, there would be no retrospective application. So we would take a cumulative effect adjustment for the leases that are in effect at the beginning of the period in which this would become effective. The discount rate that would be used would be as of that year, not adjusted based on whenever the lease may have begun. And also that the fair value be measured at that cumulative date. And then the liability and right to use asset be set equal. That's a kind of an A, B thing, and our recommendation is a type B anyway. So that's generally our thought.
Okay. Any thought in terms of the users of those financial statements, again, in this particular case, bond rating agencies and rating agencies and others, as to any comparability concerns here?
They might have such concerns. It would depend on the materiality of leasing. So I think offering retrospective application for comparatives would be fine. And then if a preparer decided that, or had a rating agency say, we really do need to see that in full comparative, then they could elect to do that if they wanted to.
All right. We next have Mark.
We looked at some of the accommodations and actually thought those were helpful for private companies, so appreciated that. As we looked at the retrospective or modified retrospective application, again, because of the volume of the leases and having to track back to all that information, I think that would be very challenging. We didn't talk about the prospect of running two systems parallel for a long period of time, 25 or 30 years. There may be some challenges there, but it will be very difficult to come back. We talked a little bit earlier about some of the big pieces of equipment at a hospital or a health system, which would be an MRI. You might have some CAT scanners. And there are a number of those large pieces of equipment, but there are thousands of smaller pieces of equipment that exist in the rooms and in the operating rooms. That's where the challenge lies here in terms of the volume. All the smaller items that, you know, trying to track that paper and keep track of all those are going to be a challenge.
Just out of curiosity, what's the average useful life of an MRI or a CAT scan?
I would say because of obsolescence often, it's, you know, maybe 7-8 years, maybe 10 years. A lot of the smaller stuff, you know, that could be anywhere from 1 to 3 years.
Jeff, quick comment on that.
Yep.
Since we deal with this space, yep. It's interesting you asked that question because they used to do 64 slice, now it went up to 128. Philips has actually found that people are back down to buying 64 slice MRI machines because 128 became almost too perfect. I mean, I don't know if too perfect is the right word, but almost too much detail. 64 was good. So, I mean, we have people, infusion pumps. Infusion pumps will last 10 to 15 years. I mean, the FDA qualifications that go around something like that, they're very, very stringent. So we would argue that a lot of the equipment, and we can prove it, lasts a lot longer than what most people think the equipment will last.
Okay. So you may have some fairly long tails then here on some of the equipment.
And that's where we argue this type A, type B, and it's not just for big marine equipment or rail. It could be for our equipment as well. Sorry.
So, Jeff, is that because the doctors didn't know what they were looking at, or they didn't need the additional details?
What's that order?
Okay. Go ahead, Annette.
just brief. I really kind of agree with Mark's comment. I think the, you know, you've got a lot of little stuff. I think if, you know, I hadn't really thought about what Matt just said, but I think if you, if we, there could be a way where you did like a cumulative effect and you didn't have to go back and figure out, you know, in those prior years. And I'm thinking in this case more about my public company friends is more than us, as we don't, we wouldn't have to go, but go back and find all the things that were active during those periods of time and figure out what you should have done, you know, earlier on. But if you could do some kind of cumulative effect adjustment and just pick a single discount rate and do it at one point in time, that I think that would be doable. I don't really like, I mean, I probably disagree with some, but I think purely prospective doesn't really work for me either. I think, you know, you do get to a situation where you just don't have comparative financial statements. We don't have I don't think we would have a big issue with our, you know, bonding agencies or financing people, because they really are, they're just cash flow people. They're really, in our business, they're just cash flow people. So the balance sheet is not a big thing for them. But I think that's our personal situation. But I think for people, if there could be just an easy way to get caught up at one point in time and not have to go back so many years. I think that's what really bothers the public people, because they've got to go back 5 or 6 years just to get their summary information in their SEC filings up to speed.
I think that's what we were trying to achieve with the modified retrospective.
Right.
Full retrospective was all the way back. I'm not sure if there's a cum effect in it, but I don't think that's the important thing. It could go right to retained earnings. But that is the idea behind the modified retrospective, is not having to go back beyond the initial year of application.
Okay.
If I could just add, because we are a private company, what I would observe is even private companies have requirements to show detailed comparable financials at times, and I'm thinking of things like M&A transactions or large refinancings or discussions around strategic alternatives like becoming a public company, so that despite the efforts, I think, of the board to perhaps offer a modified or even go as far as saying it's simply perspective, the costs that a company like ours, who have, as I said, over 1 million pieces of equipment, and we're ultimately talking here then about accounting for them as at an asset level, asset by asset, to this level of detail, the cost in going back and redoing what you might do for an offering memorandum, 5 years of financials, whether it's a mandated requirement pursuant to the FASB or not, is vast. So it's just something to keep in mind.
Okay, so we've talked a bit about transition. Let's go back to disclosures. I know only John weighed in, or whoever was the first person speaking, I think it was John, weighed on disclosures. But what about the disclosures that are being proposed for lessors and lessees? You all in agreement on it? No, okay, guys.
Well, for lessors, I just go back and echo what I said earlier, which is we believe today the disclosures are adequate to understand our business, because ours is an asset-intensive business, and there's ample information not only about the assets but about how we finance them disclosed in the financials today.
I agree with Steve.
Anyone else, especially from the lessee side? Go ahead, Doug.
Question for lessors. There's been some reference to analyst reports and others that, you know, I think you've cited, saying that the accounting model is, you know, works pretty well for them, and maybe even more pejorative than that, they would unwind the accounting model, but did call for potentially additional disclosure with respect to residuals. Do you see any potential benefit there, or are your, you know, users of financial statements able to get enough information?
I mean, I can say from our perspective, because it's a relatively ubiquitous asset, that the value by vintage doesn't change dramatically. It changes by, as I said earlier, factors that are market-driven. So I don't think we'd have a problem if there were some additional disclosure requirements, but I don't know that they would necessarily aid the user in terms of, you know, understanding our business, because they see the value against which they lend every month. I mean, every month that we have to borrow money, which is every month, we submit a borrowing base certificate with an updated disclosure on the net book value of the containers, and they understand the composition of those assets. We finance discrete asset-owning entities. I mean, it's just a business that has a financing structure that is asset-intensive, so the users of the financials get that part, or else they don't participate.
Okay, any other comments about disclosures? Go ahead, John.
This is about non-public. I don't know if we're ready to move to that.
Yeah, you could, unless there's anybody else on disclosures, we'll go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, just struggled a little bit trying to understand what you wanted out of the management strategy and risk management, because if you have a guarantee, I understand that. If you plan to release, I guess, or sell the asset at the termination of the lease. But I wasn't really sure. It seemed like it was getting into speculative-type disclosures, and I wasn't quite sure what was intended to be covered there in terms of why that was necessary. And as a result, I didn't think it should be kept.
All right, go ahead, John, about the non-public entity reliefs.
So our committee is, as I mentioned, primarily regional local practitioners. And first, we would suggest that the private company council be consulted about this directly, give their comments. Some specific suggestions we would make are that non-public entities should be permitted to immediately charge all indirect cost to expense. The lease liability, the remeasurement of the lease liability for changes in the index rate, that charge or credit should be charged to be allowed to be charged to operations immediately instead of the asset. Non-public entities should be permitted to limit reassessment of economic incentives to extend or renew a lease to transactions only where there's a modification of the lease terms as a simplification. Non-public entities should be able to include all property leases as type A leases if they wish to simplify. And then the suggestion about the doing the change prospectively for non-public entities, if not for all entities, were the suggestions of the committee.
So a couple things. First, as a reminder, Steve Brown from the PCC is here, and this is a topic that we've discussed at the last couple of PCC meetings at least, and it's certainly a topic we'll continue to discuss with the PCC. That's a very important project for them in their advisory role of for the FASB on ongoing FASB projects. Question I had for you is on the various reliefs that you suggest. I know you've said for non-public entities, would they be things that, why wouldn't you want those also for public entities?
Well, the committee didn't object to them generally, but they thought it's more trouble to capitalize them. And in the case of a non-public entity, again, it's often asset-based lending, cash flow-based lending, and may not make as much difference to the bankers was the thought, and it would just simplify things for the non-public entity.
Okay.
I don't think the committee would object if it was changed generally, but that was specifically their comment.
Okay. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I would expect real estate would object just because some of their direct costs can be significant. I mean, they get into huge lease up commissions and so forth. If they had to expense those right away, I think they would object to that.
I think our suggestion is to allow, if they want to expense it. So if they didn't want to, they could capitalize it.
Okay. Anyone else on either the public, the non-public entity reliefs that have been proposed, as well as any others that you believe should be proposed?
Could I just ask one other question? I'm not sure that I heard you properly, but did you say that the group you represent wanted the ability to classify all leases as type A leases?
Yes, if to simplify, just if that would be an option. So real estate leases could be, yes, again, for non-public entities.
And so in that case, again, another one of these trade-off issues, you're saying that in the name of simplification, they'd be willing to have a completely front-loaded P&L?
That's what our committee agreed to, yes. That's what they suggest.
And I guess I'm just not sure I understand. Maybe I can talk to you afterwards about it. I just don't understand the simplification part of that.
Well, the committee thought it would be simpler just to not have to make the decision about whether it's a type A, type B, not have to have two separate models to account for these things, just treat them all the same. It would make the accounting easier. That was the underlying idea. Okay.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I think this comes back to what we view as a problem, and I think, I don't want to speak for Steve, but I think if Steve might see this as a problem as well, is that's not truly what is our economic model and what's really happening on a transaction if I have to book all my income up front. I mean, I'm getting back to basic accounting things I learned in my first accounting classes. You recognize income when you've been able to recognize it, and that would be month one, month two, month three, month four, month five, month six, not all 36 months or 60 months up front. So to recognize all that income up front, I don't see how that's true.
Go ahead, John.
If I could just clarify, our committee liked the current proposal better than the last one, where there's a type A, type B generally. But what we're suggesting is that if a company just wants to do type A leases and not mess with this type B thing, that should be okay for non-public companies. That's the suggestion, not that we change the whole model. Just to make it simpler for a company that may have a real estate lease and a bunch of other leases, just if they want to treat them the same, then fine.
It's a lessee issue, not a lessor issue.
Right.
Yes, correct.
Although we have heard from lessors of other types of equipment other than the types that you all lease that, you know, they're concerned about leasing the same thing essentially early in its life versus late in its life, and how do they explain to their users the different type A and type B accounting for essentially the same thing. And that's a complicating factor.
Yeah, and I think that's a realistic issue in our business as well. In our particular instance, though, depending on how you define the term, I mean, I said earlier that it's 15 years in Marine service, but it's 50 years in its full service. And if we look at it as a slice, you know, 1/10 of a 50-year period for a 5-year lease versus a third in terms of, you know, the 15-year life, it can have a significant difference. So,
and by the way, I think this issue only comes up when you release something, right, a renewal, because you're looking at the remaining life at that point as opposed to the original life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and we do that all the time. Yeah. I mean, we see assets back 3, 4, 5, 6 times over a 12 to 15-year life cycle. It would clearly create some challenges.
Go ahead, Michael. Oh, okay, no comments. Anything else on the area of the non-public entity release? I wanted you guys maybe to comment on. Oh, go ahead, John.
Just one other thought. I should say that my comments were really for lessees. Our members don't really have lessors as clients, or rarely would. The other comment generally from our committee was that it was just really hard to read this document, that it was hard to follow. People and a specific comment, for example, is that if you look at the examples some of the examples are backwards. I've lost my place here in my notes, but there are examples that relate to the very last section, which is transition, and they're earlier in the document. And so you're trying to read those, and then you get – and so just the organization, I think, is a little cumbersome. And also the language is cumbersome. I mentioned this earlier. I ran this through my spell check and did a reading level, and it's 17.8, which is 6 years almost of graduate school. So, that's common in our standards. We had a project when I was on ACSEC to look at writing standards and with simpler language. And just if we could make it easier to read, that would be helpful.
I don't know if Larry wanted to comment on that.
No.
I'm not saying the current standard is easier.
We do have an initiative to look at the our codification structure, language, et cetera. And,
just so we don't leave that hanging like there's some secret thing here. Yeah. I mean, part of the organization of the ASU has to do with the organization of the codification. And that has to, we try to put things in the document in the order that they would be in the COD. And so some of us were grinning when you said that, because those of us that reviewed the document before it went final or got issued were making some of the same comments, that this seems to be out of order. And then we were reminded, oh, it's because of the codification. So
thank you.
So there is a method to the madness, although maybe it is madness.
Okay. The one final area in this section I wanted to see if we get some comments on what is the proposal to change our guidance with regard to related party leases. Are people in favor of that change? People disagree with that change? And again, the change was to look at the legally enforceable form of the lease, emphasize related party notes rather than what current GAAP has you do, which is try to figure out what the underlying substance is. What do people think of that approach? That one issue, notwithstanding,
yeah,
that we talked about earlier.
I reiterate my comments earlier. Yeah. I would agree with Tom that probably it may not be a universal change, but there might be some carve out for things where they're all part of one operating unit, you know, where they're really all part of one consolidating company.
Okay.
Because I think that adds a complexion that we probably don't really need.
Okay, any final plea here. Is there anything else from a private company or not-for-profit perspective that we need to take into consideration as we're redeliberating this proposal? Go ahead, Matt.
Jeff, our APC felt that there'd be a need for a significant transition time, especially if we're having to go back to the government and try to re-educate them on conceptual interests and all that kind of thing. So 4 years was one of the numbers thrown out.
Anyone else want to weigh in about that? Or any other issues? Okay. Go ahead, Mark.
So at the end of the day, our goal here is to really improve the financial statements for the users. Mm-hmm. And as we talked about the amount of detail in here, you know, the assumptions related to the term of a lease, the discount rates, variable lease payments, I just want to make sure that we believe at the end of the day what winds up on the balance sheet is going to be something more meaningful to the user, and that there's going to be consistency if you had 10 different organizations look at the same exact portfolio of leases.
Thank you, Mark. Mark's actually already transitioning into our last area, which is we'll go around the table, and everyone, I'd ask you to make some concluding comments, anything that you haven't stressed or would like to reemphasize. Just be as brief as you can be, but say anything you'd like to say here. Let's start with Michael.
Overall, it's just more comments about reducing complexity of the individual components. There's an old saying about work. You can have something good, fast, or cheap. Choose any two. You can't have all three. And in this case, I think there's some similarities. Some of the conceptual complexities versus the concept of simplifying are going to be at odds. And so I think anything you can do with how the mechanics work that simplifies the mechanics is going to go a long way in helping smaller companies perceive it as being less complex. That would involve things like interest. I think as lessors, there could be a lot of considerations regarding having to go get fair value on equipment. That could be an expensive proposition. There's just a lot of moving parts, and those parts add to complexity, which ultimately make it more difficult to understand if you're a user, if I've got to figure out what are the three or four pieces I have to add up to figure out what the lease payment is. And I think that you guys have done a great job conceptualizing and putting things into a framework where everything fits. I just think that as a result, the complexity is too high. And I think that, I know you've heard that, but it's, I think you have to make more compromise to get the simplicity back into it.
Okay. Matt, you're next.
From the perspective of colleges and universities, we've offered our pointed comments about certain particular sections, and I won't reiterate those. I think the heart of this is disclosure when we look at the users of our financial statements, because if the main focus is on what are our obligations and what are our cash flows going to be, we would just stress to the board in re-deliberations that perhaps disclosure be more highly emphasized, perhaps than it currently is, and that comprehensive disclosure is something we're for, but perhaps the model doesn't need to be more complicated in order to achieve that.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Go ahead, Steve. Steve, if you wanted as a PCC member to say anything here.
Well, I would want to thank you all for coming to the roundtable, and I will take all of this information back and talk to my colleagues on the PCC. It's very helpful information, so I appreciate that very much.
Okay, and I'll ask our board members to make parting comments in a little bit as well. Steve, go ahead.
I would just like to thank you again for making time to process all the feedback and make these sessions available to us. These are obviously critical issues to businesses like ours, so we're grateful to have the opportunity to do this and to meet with you face-to-face. I'd go back and just reiterate a couple of things that are takeaways, really, from our analysis and review of the materials that we've seen posted on the website, that it appears, at least from the financial user community, as we can best determine it, banks that represent a third of the total assets in the United States, who are probably the single biggest users of financial statements, that they would prefer something like enhanced disclosure rather than this kind of a wholesale modification. Really, as you deliberate this, you prioritize, I guess maybe is the right word. It's not my place to instruct you what to do, but that you put at the top of the list those financial statement users' needs and really, I think, carefully assess how much of an impact a change like this will have on their ability to determine creditworthiness. I used to be a senior credit officer at a number of financial institutions and can't recall of a situation where a company failed as a consequence of the disclosure or limitations on disclosure in the footnotes for of its leases and its lease-related obligations. I'd ask you to give serious consideration to excluding lessors from the adoption of these, type A, type B modifications. I know symmetry is something that is important, but I think at the end of the day, what the user community, including the credit rating agencies, are feeding back is that it's not necessary, that they understand that the business as it is today, and then absent any of that, would ask that you think seriously about expanding that type B classification, because I do think there are other long-lived assets that don't have the same usage or use up, if you will, profile that that is similar to real estate.
Okay, Jeff.
Again, thank you as well. Thank you to the FASB board members, to the staff as well, for putting this together. There's others a few thousand miles away who could probably learn from this a little bit. So the objective of the revised lease accounting exposure draft is to recognize lease assets and liabilities on the balance sheet and disclose key information. Again, I would reiterate what has already been said, that from a lessor accounting standpoint, this is already done. It's on the balance sheet, and all the feedback that I've received from the people who use our financial statements, they're happy with what's there. I think there would be a lot of work that would go into this. I know from our company standpoint, there would be with no real benefit. And I think when we're looking at these types of items, there needs to be a benefit if we're going to incur the cost or at least some benefit. And up till now, I've not had any real feedback on what that benefit would be. So I would ask and make the same plea, perhaps, that Lessor County is excluded from this. Regarding symmetry, I've talked to people about this, and I think the only way you get real symmetry is if you're looking at that financial statement from the lessor and the lessee at the exact same time to see if symmetry has occurred. I know in theory it sounds good, but real symmetry, I see a very hard time of that occurring. And then with that, I think from the government standpoint, I think that's a real issue. It's an issue for us as well with the interest expense. I know that might not necessarily come into play from, I think Larry said before, why should that be our problem? At the end of the day, we are an economy. We're all trying to work together. We need to be repaid for a commitment that we've been given. And if all of a sudden the government goes, hey, this is interest expense, I'm not going to repay you for that, that's not helping anybody. And then the final comment would be, I really think there should be more than just property in this type B option. I think there's a lot of assets that go into it, not just property.
John.
Well, thank you for hosting this accounting party here. I have parties like this at my house on Friday evenings. I invite my accounting friends over and we talk about new accounting standards. Do you have parties like that? I have no friends anymore, so I don't. anyway, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here. And I also think that it's admirable that you're taking on what's probably the most complicated set of standards in our profession, lease accounting standards. I taught a 12-hour course on lease accounting once. Two people died of boredom. But it's very complicated, and there isn't a right answer, I don't think. I worked on participating mortgages for 10 years, and at one meeting we decided that it was like the story of the three blind men and the elephant. You know, one grabs the trunk and says it's like a snake, another one goes against the side and says it's like a wall, and the third grabs the leg and says it's like a tree. And I think that as you look at leases, you can look at it in a number of different ways and get different answers. So what we need is an answer that works. And our committee deliberated the first proposed standard and weren't wild about it. We like the second one better, and it seems like this would work. So there was no great opposition. The only real opposition was to the transition, which people didn't like much because trying to go back and figure this out before the fact they didn't like. But it seems like a standard that would work. And I think the bottom line is we need to come to an answer here with this. It could go on forever, and that's kind of how our committee feels. We need to come to a solution and move on. So good luck with that, as somebody said earlier.
Okay. Mark?
Well, I'd also like to thank the board and the staff for what has been years of deliberation. And you've hundreds and probably at this point thousands of comments letters in this area. Not to reiterate what I said before about the complexity of this, that clearly exists. I think we really wouldn't have an objection to bringing assets and liabilities on the books. The challenge is how to get a number there that everybody can agree to. And that's what I think everybody's struggling with. You know, we talked about disclosure, and I guess I wonder if there's a possibility of it, instead of going through this very complex, onerous process to get to a number that I bet 10 different organizations would get the 10 different answers on, is there any way to disclose gross information that would be beneficial to a user, and they could use their own judgment on what they wanted to do with it, but at least they have the information there that everybody would universally agree on.
Okay, Annette?
Well, again, I think this has been a good day. I was here this morning and listened and here and really appreciate the time of all the FASB staff to come and listen to people offer their comments, and I think there's been a lot of good discussion. Not a lot of new to say from what other people have said. I certainly agree with the expansion of the Type B, looking broader at that and not having it just be real estate, because I think there are a lot of other leases that could potentially fall in that category. I certainly think for private companies or public companies that more of a straight line, certainly in our business, more of a straight line income recognition is really helpful and better representative of the type of business that we have and how we are using these leases versus having a financing kind of front-end loaded one. I think that's important. I do think this government thing is a big deal. It's not only a big deal for my company, but for all the companies in my industry. And I think most of us do quite a bit of business with the government. So I think trying to look at that. So I think looking at some of these options, we talked about some today. You know, don't know how everyone's going to feel about this, but on shorter term leases with interest rates being relatively low, you know, maybe you do a gross presentation. You know, I mean, I could actually warm up to that. So I think there are some situations like that that ought to be considered and certainly considered as options, because I think they give people an ability to do things that would be simpler. But I would agree with what other people say. This is a very complex standard, and when you sit back and begin to look at what it's going to take in hours and systems and things like that, and we're a big company, but for your staff and for your systems and the cost of it, it's pretty daunting. And so anything that can be done to make it simpler, back to Michael's call, even if it's not perfect, but it's kind of good enough, I think would be really helpful, because the practical application of this is going to be very difficult for companies, not just private ones, but public ones as well. So, you know, any kind of practical, expedient kind of thing that could be thought through would be very, very helpful.
Go ahead, Brett.
I really did like John's point that there is no right answer as we talk about this. And so, you know, it's also been said that there's been a lot of improvement since the 2010 exposure draft. And the thing that I want to highlight is that I think that, you know, the comparison ought to really be to the existing guidance, that's ought to be what we're trying to improve. With the 2013 exposure draft, I guess I view that as falling short really for two primary reasons. One is when it comes to the financial statement users that will benefit from this, I'm still not clear who those financial statement users are. There's a number of different financial statement users, and I believe that they all have varying needs. I don't believe that those financial statement users have a consensus on what information will help them either in the financial statements or in the disclosures. As an example, Great America is a financial statement user, and the way that we use the financials, these changes will not benefit us. We use the disclosures today in more of a cash flow type analysis, and so that's just one way that we use the financial statements. In addition, from a cost-benefit analysis, when I think about the benefits that this will offer, as I mentioned, we're a financial statement user, and I don't feel that this will benefit us. Also, from a financial statement preparer's perspective as a lessor, as I discussed earlier, our financial statements won't change materially, but in either case of a financial statement user or a preparer, we believe the cost will be significant of implementing this. We firmly believe that the existing standards for both lessee and lessor accounting provide adequate information to financial statement users. And we also believe that there's already cost-effective systems in place for financial statement users and financial statement preparers to comply with that guidance.
Thank you, Brett. And finally, Carol.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for having this roundtable and for all the work you've done on this. And I encourage you to have the same level of outreach to bankers and sureties and other financial statement users. One of the big concerns in Milburn Rand Company is that there will be dramatic changes to financial statements, and the bankers they work with won't be aware of them and won't be prepared to deal with those changes. And the last thing I would like to say is I would really appreciate anything you could do to decrease complexity. I totally agree with Michael and Annette on that one.
Next, I'd like Danielle to update us on our remaining outreach efforts following this and, I guess, tomorrow's Singapore roundtable.
Okay, great. So since the ED has been issued in May, the staff and the boards have been very busy with several different types of outreach activities. We have been speaking with users across the world, actually over 200 users we've spoken with. We've met with lessees, lessors. We've tried to get some detailed information on the specific costs that would be incurred to implement the proposals. We have had several roundtables already in Singapore, London, two in London, two in Norwalk, two here, and then the Singapore one tomorrow. I'm sorry, I already said Brazil. Brazil was the first one. And we're over 600 comment letters right now. So, and we do still have a few more meetings with bankers, with users, with some lessees, some lessors, and we have also specifically reached out to non-public lenders and non-public lessees and lessors as well. So the staff plan to summarize all of the outreach activities, including a comment letter analysis, and provide that at a public board meeting in November, at a joint board meeting, and also come up with a redeliberation plan on how to move forward on the project. And we hope to begin redeliberations in December. And then can't determine the final issuance of a final standard. Obviously, it depends on how long it takes the boards to redeliberate, make some decisions, move the ball forward. But the hope is to try to finalize in 2014. And at that point, they will consider what an appropriate effective date might be. And as was mentioned earlier, the boards will certainly consider an ample lead time between the issuance of the final standard and the actual effective date. And the boards have not specifically discussed this, but there has been precedent in the past that non-public and not-for-profit entities would most likely get a year deferral of the effective date beyond what public companies would have. So that's still yet to be decided, but something to consider.
Can I just ask you a quick question about the interaction with the IASB? And have you learned in this process that the European market views any of these concepts or the way they analyze and use financial statements differently than what's typically found here in the United States in terms of how they approach use of footnotes and delving into details and spreading financials?
I think the feedback has been pretty similar around the world.
Okay.
And the feedback that we have heard from users has been that leases do create assets and liabilities, and they do think there should be something on the balance sheet. That has been a universal view of the users that we have spoken to, both here in the United States and elsewhere.
Thank you.
Okay. One more thing I'd like us to do before I call upon our four board members to make concluding comments, and that is I'm going to turn it over to Jim Croker, as the vice chair of the FASB, to extend an invitation to our audience.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. And we're going to do something here that I think is hasn't been done at the other roundtables, but we do want to open up the floor to any of our observers if you want to make some comments. I think we'll leave 20 to 30 minutes if we have multiple people. If you have comments, we'd ask that you try to limit those to about 5 minutes or so. And we're privileged to have a representative from Representative Sherman's office, a member of Congress, who's joining us, John Alford. There's I guess you'd describe it as a statement or a letter that's been sent. It'll be made available as part of the comment letter. So I'll turn the
absolutely
floor
thank
over
you.
To you.
So I work for Congressman Brad Sherman. I'm here on his behalf. He's a senior member of the Committee on Financial Services in the U.S. House of Representatives. A few hours ago, Congressman sat down with FASB Chairman Russ Golden and was kind enough to meet with the Congressman. And what I'm about to say is essentially a shortened version of the Congressman's conversation with him, or at least the Congressman's side of it. For 17 years, I'll say it in the first person, I've been the loudest voice on the relevant House committee, the Committee on Financial Services, in favor of the independence of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, FASPA. A few years ago, I also co-founded the CPA Caucus in Congress. To some extent, my credibility with my colleagues on that committee is dependent upon FASPA making reasonable decisions. My arguments in favor of FASPA independence will seem impractical, even delusional, if the FASPA adopts the current exposure draft on leases. The harm to the economy, particularly to small and medium-sized businesses, is far greater than you can imagine. Congress has urged you not to adopt the exposure draft at different times, including a letter dated May 14, 2013, signed by myself and a bipartisan group of 12 others, a letter dated May 17, 2012, signed by myself and a bipartisan group of 60 others. To my knowledge, virtually all of the members of Congress aware of your exposure draft have urged you not to adopt it. The only reason you haven't received a letter signed by hundreds of members of Congress is simply that many of my colleagues have not yet focused on it. To adopt the exposure draft when FASPA's own investor advisory committee has determined that the proposed changes are not needed by users of financial statements would be mystifying. In terms of the economic harm of adopting the exposure draft on leases, as detailed in the comment letters, a study by the Equipment Leasing and Financial Foundation indicated that by capitalizing operating leases would add $2 trillion of debt to the balance sheets of U.S.-based corporations, dramatically increasing the cost of capital and perhaps stalling our fragile economic recovery. Accounting rules should not have such a dramatic effect on the economic activity. They're meant to be neutral means of scorekeeping. Another study highlighted the relevant comment, highlighted in several comment letters commissioned by the 2012 National Association of Realtors and the Real Estate Roundtable, Business Owners and Managers Association International, and others, says the following. In the best case scenario, the exposure draft would destroy 190,000 U.S. jobs and reduce U.S. GDP by $27.5 billion annually. In the worst case scenario, the cost would be 3.3 million jobs and a reduction of U.S. GDP by $478.6 billion annually. As noted by many commentators, there's been a shift towards shorter, there will be a shift towards shorter lease terms, which will raise the cost or possibly make unavailable the construction of permanent financing that leasers must obtain in order to successfully build and lease commercial and industrial real estate. We would have hundreds of construction workers here today if they understood what was at stake. In terms of the social effects of adopting the exposure draft on leases, in addition to these egregious problems identified by the numerous commentators, Congress has a substantial national interest in community continuity. Distorting the economic behavior of lessees and lessors is not only bad for both parties in the transaction, it's bad for the communities represent. Close down factories, even if they're relocated in some other location in the U.S., create a social cost. Our tax policy favors continuity in community homeownership and continuity of ownership of real estate, which is subject to capital gains tax only upon the change of ownership. My state and many others have adopted property tax laws designed to assure community continuity. I doubt that this is an issue that the board has yet considered. Penalizing long-term leases will do great social harm. It is important that the FASPA show that it is focused on the potential harms of the exposure draft, as detailed by the studies mentioned above. In addition, the IEC has determined that this exposure draft does not improve financial statements from the standpoint of users. The failure of FASPA to do full-blown field testing of this proposed change in accounting for leases dramatically undermines its credibility in Congress and elsewhere. It's almost as if the board wishes to remain oblivious to the implementation cost, practicality, consistency of results, negative impacts, and unintended consequences of this ill-conceived change. Additionally, as you well know, the exposure draft standard would, when it take effect, immediately trigger the violation of many loan covenants. My concern, however, is for the rest of American businesses. The FASPA staff has shown phenomenal disconnect with the world outside of Fortune 1000 companies. The Fortune 1000 companies play a very substantial role in drafting their loan documents. When they issue bonds to a public market, the issuer, borrower, drafts the documents. When these large companies negotiate major loan agreements, they're represented by experienced legal counsel. When the borrower drafts the loan document, care is often taken so that a change in accounting principles does not trigger a loan default. Even so, many 30-year multi-billion dollar bond offerings don't have a savings clause. What about the rest of American businesses? These businesses borrow money from banks and other lenders pursuant to loan documents drafted by the lenders. They may on occasion be able to change a paragraph or two here or there, but all the standard provisions are drafted by and for the lender. In virtually all of these cases, the borrower does not have the acumen to suggest that loan covenants are calculated according to then existing accounting principles, nor does the borrower have the bargaining strength to insist that changes in such technical provisions of the loan documents be effectuated. Thus, the adoption of this exposure draft would cause a large percentage of American businesses that use GAAP to be in violation of their loan covenants. Your staff has also put forward the idea that the banks will simply waive the violation of the loan covenants or negotiate new provisions calling for different balance sheet ratios. This also shows an absurd lack of connection with the business reality faced by most small and medium-sized businesses. Some banks will want to be generous, kind, and reasonable to their borrowers. They may want to voluntarily waive or modify loan covenants, even if the value of the security pledged for the loan has declined, as is true for virtually all pre-2009 loans. In those cases, they face federal and or state bank examiners who will now penalize them for their generosity, even performing loans that are modified subject to new bank and examiner analysis. A bank that decided to be reasonable and waive loan covenants might find itself disadvantaged by bank examiners. This is particularly true if the value of the security for the loan has declined. In the majority of cases affecting perhaps millions of small businesses, lenders will demand any of the following: immediate payment of the loan, higher interest rate, or personal guarantee from the business owners. Transition rules can't solve the loan covenants problem. This problem cannot be solved by a transition rule of less than 30 years, and of course a transition period of that length would make the accounting principle non-viable. Many of the bond indentures provide for terms of 30 years or even longer in length. While some of the bond agreements applicable to publicly traded debt contain provisions stating balance sheet ratios are to be calculated according to accounting principles that in existence when the bonds were issued, some do not. Virtually none of the loan agreements signed by non-public and especially smaller companies contain such an out for the borrower. And many long-term lease agreements, the very object of your concern, may be voided by the lessor's option if the lessee, often a small business with little bargaining power, fails to maintain certain balance sheet ratios. In conclusion, The fact that there will not be 500 business owners and their employees marching out in front of this hearing is not because you will destroy fewer jobs and fewer businesses than you imagine. It is only because the owners of these businesses and their employees do not have the time, resources, or inclination to study FASPIC shows exposure drafts. And your outreach efforts have been so inadequate that they remain unaware of the tsunami that is about to hit them. The change in accounting rules that are proposed by the exposure draft is simply too important to be left to those very few Americans who regularly read FASPA exposure drafts. It is time to field test. It is time to have real public outreach. Very truly yours, Congressman Brad Sherman, CPA.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other members of the audience that would like to give some remarks or a brief statement?
I just have...
Come on, speak into the mic.
Thank you. I just have one question as to...
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, my name's Terry Fast. Okay. I'm with Triton Container.
Terrific.
With Steve. But just, it's great that the board is having these outreach comments and so forth, but there's been some talk about users. What do users really use in the financial statements? And is there a public forum that you've gone out and asked for users' comments that we can we can hear what the users really are looking for? You've had, I think there was mentioned that there's 200 interviews that you've had, but are they published anywhere on the FASB that we can listen to their exact comments?
We have posted on our website a summary of our outreach activities, and it talks about the different types of users that we have talked to and some of their different views. The meetings that we have with users are generally one-on-one, and they're not public, and they generally don't like attribution, and we don't get a lot of comment letters from users, but we have spoken with them. We do have some comment letters that they have posted on our website, so that will be taken into consideration. But they have very different ways of analyzing financial information, and the different types of users have very different needs from the financial statements and different ways they want to analyze the financial statements. So we've had a hard time finding a uniform view among users as to what best model would accomplish their results of analyzing the financial statements.
But that summary, Danielle, isn't just the types of users, but also their commentary or what perspective they had. So it does summarize not just who, but the perspective.
And that's been recently posted?
Yes, within the last couple of days.
And okay, thank you.
Sorry, just to add to that, too, they do make adjustments, and they do agree that they're assets and liabilities. We have heard that view.
And in the letters that have been posted from the Bank of America or the CFO of BNP and these... $2 and $3 trillion, the Wells Fargo guys. I mean, how do you reconcile? And I'm not trying to challenge what you're saying. I'm just asking, how do you reconcile a third of the banking assets in the United States telling you or submitting their comments saying, please don't change this, with these other users who are saying, we'd like some kind of modification?
Except frequently the letters that we receive from those types of institutions are being written from the perspective of them being a preparer as opposed to a user. So,
preparer of financial statements.
Yes.
Because there are lessees for obviously a lot of branches and so forth, too.
So we have, but I think it's fair to say on the lessor side, we have got feedback from users that has said don't change the model.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, as I read through those letters seem to be written from the perspective of a commercial, view, not so much from a lessee view, but from a fundamental, either a credit view or some of those businesses are in the leasing, some of those banks are in the leasing business.
Yes.
So then they also have a view from that perspective, but certainly taken into consideration the fact that they use those they too are users of those financial statements.
That is true.
When I think, we heard from, your perspective when you started out today, said you're not just a preparer, but a user, and right. I think we heard the same from, some of the panelists this morning. So I think making sure we're balanced about there isn't just one and I think people have said that there isn't a monolithic group of users who say one thing, and that's, I think, very fair to what you've said today.
We would have a preference if users would publicly state their views, but many of them have company policies that they cannot publicly state their views. And so we do the best job that we possibly can of reaching out as broadly and holistically to the user community to end up getting their views. Now, all of you that were here today recognize that most of this is from the preparer audit community, and your views were not uniform, right? Well, it's the same case in the investor community, is that they're not always uniform. But what is most surprising in the leasing circumstance is a significant, if not vast, majority of those users do agree that for on the lessee side that there's assets and liabilities that should be reflected on the financial statements. Now, they understand that they may use that only as a starting point to their analysis, and that they're going to, like any other financial reporting information, then process it within their models and do some changes to it to be able to reflect what they think is the best sort of thing. But personally, this board member finds it very important that what we're trying to do is improve information for users in our economy. And when they speak in one very common voice, that's going to be very influential to me going forward. But beyond the vast majority supporting assets and liabilities for lessees on the balance sheet, there is a lot of diversity in the user's views about the rest of the model. And that's going to be a challenge, just like it is a challenge for us to listen to the various views we heard today. And you're not fully representative of the variety of views that we're going to get through the whole process. But I assure you, we are not locked in on any proposal at this point in time. We have a public deliberative process, and it's very serious for us. We are out here to listen. And we are going to re-deliberate as best as possible all the issues that we've heard in this process. There will be changes. I can't predict what the changes will be because I'm only one board member. But it'll be an interesting thing as we work together to try to be reflective best of the economics of leasing transactions that we far better understand as a result of the input we've received out of this process, and we'll move forward to best faithfully represent leasing transactions as best as possible.
So that's your closing statement.
Jeff, let me see if there's anyone else that would like to. Yeah, I see we have a representative from the ABA that would like to.
After, please introduce yourself. Yeah, this is Mike Gallott. I'm with the American Bankers Association, and I guess I felt a little bit compelled after the reading we just heard a little bit, because I think that at least our member banks aren't out to get people, and I think that there will be adjustments made if there are changes, significant changes made to. Bank or to their customers' balance sheets. But I think that the issues that were just brought up by the congressman in regards to transition are very legitimate. There is a lot of work that is going to be needed to be done. You know, for example, on, you know, trying to educate and trying to, if there are things to allow the so-called interest charges to be reimbursable, and those things that working with the Risk Management Association of trying to get those metrics, what those metrics, there are common metrics probably used now, what are they going to be? Those things are, that work needs to be done on a proactive basis, I think. I think from a transition perspective, to just say that, well, it'll be implemented in effective date is in 3 years. I don't think that's going to be good enough. I think that the board has to really consider doing an active effort with the various constituencies, the SEC, all the different industry groups, to say, here's how it's going. Here's the best thinking of how a transition will be smooth. And I think of all the things that were said there, I think that is the biggest issue that I think that you're going to be facing.
Thank you. I'll check one last time. I want to be fair to the 20 minutes or so.
Jim Sublaric, I'm trying to contain it. I think I heard just a minute ago that
We've gotten a lot of feedback from users of lessors financial statements, and we've also have talked to a number of lessors, and I'll speak for myself, but I think there's a much better appreciation for what the changes that we propose would do to lessors' financial statements. And I think that will help inform us in terms of where we go from a lessor perspective.
Thank you. I don't know if we have any other board member closing statements. Tom, I don't know if that really was your closing statement.
I think it sufficed.
Yeah.
other than thank you for all your input. It's always helpful to hear
Larry.
From people.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Tom said, but I think the point to emphasize is that this is not done, all right? We put out exposure drafts for a reason. And speaking for myself, I can tell you that the day we released this exposure draft wasn't necessarily the proudest day of my life. I think many of us had concerns with the model because of all of the things we've heard through the comment letter process, and that is leases are very complicated, and the variety of lease arrangements is extremely wide, and therefore to come up with a model that addresses that wide array of arrangements is very difficult. And at the same time, we are trying to come up with a converged solution with the IASB. So the fact that you have different people that view the economics of lease transactions differently leads to compromise. The fact that you're dealing with 7 board members who have different ideas at the FASB and I don't know how many ISB? 15 or 16 IASB board members who have different ideas leads to a lot of compromise. And unfortunately, compromise in accounting standard setting doesn't necessarily always lead to the best standard. And I think, as evidenced by over 600 comment letters, not necessarily everybody agrees with the compromises we've come up with to date. So I think that causes each of us individually to pause and reconsider what we're doing, because at the end of the day, we're trying to improve financial reporting. Where that will lead us, you know, I can't really predict, except for one thing. I can guarantee you that the final document is going to be different than what we have right now. It's not going to be the same. I can guarantee you that. And therefore, for people to focus on one element and get really agitated about one element in the proposed document is unfounded, because things are going to change. We're each going to evaluate the significance of the comments we receive and how those affect ultimately how users use the financial statements is going to be the major consideration that each of us individually has to make. And we have to make it at the same time evaluating the cost of implementing the changes as well as the benefits to be derived. If you go back historically, there's 2 major reasons why we added this to the agenda. One was the fact that people, you know, indicated that this was the biggest area where there were unrecorded liabilities on the balance sheet. Now, whether those meet the definition of liabilities or not varies from individual to individual, depending upon whether you view these as executory contracts or not executory contracts. And there are strong arguments on both sides of of that issue. The second reason why we added it was the complexity and the rule-based nature of FAS 13. It was, you know, FAS 13 was cited as being one of the biggest rule-based standards we have, with the ability of people to structure around. And therefore, that's another reason we added it. You know, whether we've addressed both of those issues appropriately remains to be seen. But I think, one thing I can say with utmost confidence is, while I might not be able to tell you confidently how this will shake out, I can tell you that all members of the FASB will take your comments into consideration and not fall back and just say that, look, we issued the right thing and therefore we should go forward with that.
Tara?
Yeah, I would just like to thank all of you for being here today. Thank you for participating in this. Thank you for participating in the process and writing your comment letters. And even though at the end of the day, you know, you may not feel like you get your way with the final standard, I can assure you that we as board members are impacted by your points of view, and they cause us to think and shape our points of view at the end of the day. You know, this leases standard is it's like an octopus. You know, it's multi-tentacled. And so not only can I tell you that I think that it's impossible that we can craft a final standard that's going to be satisfactory to everyone, I think that it's likely that there are very, very few people that when we get to the end of the standard will like, you know, most of the aspects of it, or certainly not all the aspects of it. So, you know, where does that leave you in terms of thinking, you know, do you win or do you lose? Well, let me tell you, yesterday we had a board meeting, and of the four board members sitting around this table right here, I think we would all agree that we were all winners and we were all losers in various aspects of what we discussed and voted on yesterday. But at the end of the day, we have to be happy with the process. And that's what it's all about. We all come from different backgrounds, just like you all do. But this whole process is set up to hopefully help us come out with something at the end that is the best that we can do. And it won't be perfect, I can assure you of that. But we're certainly trying to make it the best that it can be. And thanks for participating with us in that.
And I just wanted to close with again thanking each of you. This is an extremely important aspect of, not the only aspect of, but an extremely important aspect of our public outreach to remind us of areas, emphasize areas through the comment letter process and otherwise, where you see negative consequences of the accounting, where you say particularly it doesn't improve usefulness of financial statements, and to where you can applaud us for areas where it does. And so we're thankful for that. I think it's also helpful to hear very specific implementation suggestions on where we can be more practical in achieving the desired outcome of improving financial reporting. Certainly we want to be practical where we can, and your input is very helpful to us in doing that. So I want to thank you for that as well. I don't have any other. I think we've sort of covered the gamut in terms of closing remarks. Larry, you hit what I wanted to in terms of remembering that opinion or AP FAS 13 itself, before this project, was not viewed by many as the most easy standard to deal with. It's cited often as a source of complexity. Not too long ago, there was a year in which there were several hundred restatements in applying that guidance, which when you think of the cost of that to the economy isn't, you know, go unnoticed as well. So it isn't like we're dealing with a standard that everybody says, you nailed it on the head with that one. So again, thank you for all of your input. And Jeff, I don't know if there's anything else, or
I can just turn again, it back to thank you as well, and bring this roundtable on this day to close.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.